Hi, welcome back to another episode of the Film Experience Podcast. And I have two guests today. We're talking to Mark Blankenship from The Critical Condition.
Hello.
So just try to remember the voice.
Yeah, yes.
And we're also talking to Kurt from Your Movie Buddy, who you've read sometimes at the Film Experience.
Hello again.
If it helps, I could try to speak in an affected Southern accent.
Yeah, just play it up if you have any.
Well, Lord have mercy, I will then.
Where are you from originally, Mark?
Originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Wow.
Where we don't like to see your devil movies like y'all would like to watch. We prefer healthier and wholesomer films.
Like a good Woody Allen picture, perhaps?
Oh, Lord! He's the leader of the worst!
Woody Allen was my first sign that I was, shall we say, different than my family. I've probably told this before, but we went to see The Purple Rose of Cairo. I don't know how I convinced my parents to take us, because it's not the type of thing that my family would normally go to, but we somehow all ended up there, and we left the movie, and I'm like freaking out. I love it so much. And my entire family was like, that movie was horrible. The ending was so sad. It was like punishing us for watching the movie.
You know, similarly, the very first Woody Allen movie I ever saw was a VHS of Hannah and Her Sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, that was so beautiful. And they were really so complicated. And my parents were like, that was so boring. Nothing happened.
Isn't it so soul-crushing when that happens?
Yeah, what can you do?
If I really, really love a movie, I try to not watch it with people I think might not respond.
Right. Well, the worst is when you have someone you think is going to respond very positively in the same way you did, and then they completely disappoint you.
Well, I'm actually, I have to say, my life partner of almost 6 years hates animated films.
Oh.
I'm like, Toy Story 3, I come home and I'm like, you don't understand. I was crying. My soul was on the floor. And he's like, yeah, I'm never going to like that. And we've had to make our peace. We've had to make our peace with that.
Did he actually watch it?
No, he won't. I mean, he says that he feels he's watched and been disinterested in enough animated films in his life that he's never going back. And, you know, there's only so many battles you can fight in a day.
Hey, listeners, right about here we had some technical problems, and we also didn't want to give away too many spoilers for Midnight in Paris, because one of the joys of seeing Woody Allen's new movie is seeing how the plot develops. The trailers have smartly not given the whole game away, so let it suffice to say that it's about an engaged writer, played by Owen Wilson, who is traveling in Paris with his fiance, and he's having some career problems and, you know, just some general ennui about his life. And it's about, you know, living in the present versus romanticizing the past. And his character happens to romanticize the past quite a lot. So characters from other eras do appear in the movie. And we all enjoyed the sort of cartoon versions of these characters that presented themselves because, you know, all of us, when we romanticize the past, we don't have a full knowledge of what that past was actually like. So it sort of worked within the construct. Anyway, we rejoin the conversation now. Kurt is talking about how he related to the writer's emotional journey in the movie.
I connect to with just what I'm going on, what's going on in my life right now, transitioning to New York and meeting other people, other writers and things like that, that I really connected with, how he needed to go back in time to find people who were on his same wavelength. And yet, in the same breath, Woody was kind of saying, yeah, that's all fine and good, but you shouldn't live in the past either. So he has this little taste of it, enough to give him what he needs, but not so much that he should stay in that frame of mind.
And what did you guys feel about the way that the present-day characters, like Rachel McAdams and her parents, came across?
Well, that for me was the weakest part of the movie, because it didn't seem to have been fully thought out. Like, the heart of the movie was obviously in, you know, and I'm not saying it should have been a schematic thing where everybody has the same issues about whether they're living in the present or romanticizing the past, but I didn't feel like those characters were formed enough to help us at all with the themes of the movie.
Right.
They just seem like gross caricatures. And I felt a little bad for Rachel McAdams, actually, because it's such the typical, like, shrewish part, like something that you would see in, like, The Hangover, the original.
Totally. When I felt like it was a little disappointing because if you, for the film to only have these horrible people living in the present, it's sort of tips. I feel like the nostalgia part of the movie would have been even a little bit more compelling if there had at least been something in those people that were already in his life that he could like. You know, like if it weren't so easy to dismiss everyone in his life and love Ernest Hemingway instead. It was a little disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel the movie was challenging itself enough there, but I often feel that way about Woody Allen films,
Yeah.
that they're sort of half formed, and I don't know if that's at the speed at which he works or that he's just not at his peak powers anymore. I'm not sure.
I think the most crushing part for me was in the very end. They weren't even able to have a civil breakup. They didn't even get an opportunity to have a nice breakup. It was just the parents came in, and it was just more misery. They couldn't even have that one moment.
But you know, it's funny because I feel like I thought about all that stuff. Like I, in the moment of watching the movie, I really enjoyed it. But then I feel like afterward, as I started to think about it, that's when all of this stuff became more obvious to me and more irritating. Do you know what I mean? Like I was laughing and charmed in the middle of the experience, but then by the end of it, and I guess immediately afterwards, I realized, oh, but I could have been laughing more or charmed differently.
The humor is very sort of soft humor. There aren't big laughs, so I have been a little bit surprised that it's gotten the response it has, because I don't think it's, funny ha ha.
Right.
It's more the type of film where you're smiling at the humor.
Right. Well, except I saw it in this, Nathaniel, you may know, in the Lincoln Plaza Cinema where you go underground.
Yes.
And it's a theater filled with people who live on the Upper West Side who I think made a point of letting everyone else in the theater know that they got some of the literary references. So instead of smiling, they were doing that, ha, 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 oh, Salvador Dali, oh, and like letting us know that they thought it was funny, which was its own. That theater is always good for its own little drama in that way, anyway.
Yeah, and it's like a socioeconomic study in
Yeah,
action.
totally.
I loved, since you brought it up, I loved Adrian Brody in the movie.
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, there's that moment where he does the thing with his eyes, and it's just this uncanny flash where it threw me back in my seat.
I love that he embraced, what we had mentioned before about it not being at all, realistic portrayals so much as like sort of like imagined reality.
Right.
And so it played like a caricature, but how any of us might think of Dali. It was nice to see him do something. It's been a while since I saw him in anything where I got any enjoyment out of it.
Right, totally. Well, and to just, it seemed like that he was not doing that thing, I think he could have easily done, where he was sort of winking at us at how clever he was being. It just seemed like he was pretty sincere in the goofiness of that, and it was so fun.
Kurt, did you have any other favorite bits?
Well, I like the sort of knowing references among the characters. There's a great moment where Owen Wilson needs to find either Dolly or Brunel or something, and Gertrude Stein. I might be getting this wrong, but Gertrude Stein says something like, oh, those crazy surrealists are having a wedding, or something like that, and then it cuts to a room full of animal heads and everything, and it was just this sort of knowing reference among them that I found really funny.
Yeah.
Oh, those crazy surrealists. I'm a fan of the movie. I really liked it. I just thought it was this buffet of culture, and I do think it was relatively easy and it was tied up very nicely, but I got this real swell of pleasure by the time I got to the end, and it was just, yes, yes, it's great to walk in the rain, and I walked out very pleased.
It does feel a little easy, but it's of a piece, like, tonally, and you just accept that it's sort of like the softball.
Right, totally. And if you walk into the movie and you're kind of politically aligned, or if your politics are similar to Woody Allen's, or your enthusiasm for art is similar to Woody Allen's, you can allow yourself to be preached to in a way that's pleasing. And it's nice.
Mm-hmm.
For me, Marianne Cotillard's character, who is entirely created by Woody Allen, I think, has one of the most satisfying arcs in the movie, because she also, like Owen Wilson's character, goes through her own journey with her relationship to nostalgia mm-hmm. and the past. And I found her decisions at the end of her arc to be really satisfying, because they were a little bit open-ended and asked me to ask questions about what was happening. And it was a place where I got to make up my own mind about what was the right and wrong course for her. Mm-hmm. And I found that really satisfying. And then her acting was also really good, so that added to the mm-hmm. enjoyment.
I liked the extra layer of her being basically an artist's muse as a character, and then also being the character that, for me, helped the movie to transcend whatever humble ideas Woody Allen had about what he was doing.
Right.
Just because he doesn't, you know, he's even said this in interviews, it seems like he has sort of like a low opinion of how high he aims. I forget which interview this is, but he said that he worries that he's, you know, thrown it away, or that he didn't achieve the greatness he could have achieved, type of thing.
Right. Well, you know, speaking of interviews, you mentioned earlier that Midnight in Paris is poised to become his biggest hit in however many years, and I read some interview with him recently where he said that he never knows what's going to be a hit, because he really thought that Hollywood Ending was going to be his big breakthrough smash.
Oh,
I think it's funny. So I would imagine that he is as shocked as anyone that now 15,000 theaters or whatever are now screening.
Yeah, I remember when Hannah and Her Sisters came out. It's just showing my age, but because that was a big Oscar thing, there were a lot of interviews at the time. And I remember him being sort of dismissive of the movie, of his own movie, despite all the Oscar nominations. And, you know, he kept saying, well, Blue Velvet is the best film of this year. And if people like something, I know I've done something wrong. Like, he was sort of very misanthropic about it.
Sure. Okay, Woody.
Kurt, what's your favorite Woody Allen? Just for out of curiosity.
Manhattan, actually, which I think plays into perhaps why I love this one so much. Because I don't think, I mean, my Woody palette is not as sharp as most, I'll admit. But I think I know his work well enough to know that he's not drunk so deeply of the wonders of a city, so to speak, since Manhattan. This was, you know, the magic here is a lot more literal, but, I mean, I love Manhattan. I think just the whole urban fantasy element appealed to me again.
And how about you, Mark?
Well, there are a lot of Woody Allen movies that I have not seen. But, you know, I think Hannah and Her Sisters has stuck with me, and Annie Hall, as horribly cliche as that is, I loved both of those. Mm-hmm. Hannah and Her Sisters, I think it's just because that was the first one I saw, and I was just the right age, I think, to just enjoy it. I don't know. That one sticks with me. Of the newer camp, I have to say, I loved, like, the last 10 minutes of Match Point were so exciting to me that that's also one of my favorites, just for the last 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Match Point definitely has its strengths as a movie. My favorite is always a toss-up between Manhattan and The Purple Rose of Cairo. Cairo is maybe my favorite movie about movies, period. Fandor was doing this, you know, article and this survey about this, the site Fandor, and so we had to submit top 10 lists, And that's what topped mine for movies about movies.
Huh.
It's sort of brilliant commentary on both movies and on the people who love movies. So it's like a double layer, you know, and it's recognizing that it's, you know, the give and take between the audience and the actual
Oh.
film. I'm not explaining it well. I wrote a nice piece, but just talking, I'm not explaining
Oh, just know that nice piece is out there.
it well. Right. Segueing into the other thing I wanted to talk to you guys about quickly. Last week, I was starting to think that all of our ideas about what might be nominated for Oscars this year were wrong, and maybe we should start thinking about Midnight in Paris.
Right.
Whereas before, everybody had assumed The Tree of Life or Super 8 would be the summer pictures that made a splash. But then, as soon as I had decided that this one was a threat for the top 10, you know, especially because of the demographic that it seems to appeal to. And then they went and decided you had to have, you know, 5% number one votes
Right.
to be a Best Picture nominee. So now I'm suddenly thinking again that maybe nothing will do it, or it would have to be Tree of Life because Malick always has, you know, a fanatical fan base.
And okay, so I think I understand this new rule. There can be up to 10 Best Picture nominees, right?
Yes.
But then how is that possible if each movie has to have at least 20% of the number one votes on people's ballots? What am I missing there?
No, it has to have 5%.
5%.
5%.
Right.
So like 1 in 20 people has in within the Academy have to think
It's
you're
their
the
number one
yeah.
slot on there. Okay. I cuz that that would cuz I could not figure out how you could have 10 movies with 20% of the vote, but then clearly that's okay, now I understand.
Yeah, I mean, and theoretically, it could happen where, you know, the sort of enthusiasm was very, very divided. But I kind of doubt that we're going to see a lot of years with 8 to 10 nominees.
Right.
Just because it seems toward the end of the year that people, with the precursor awards and everything, it really, really narrows the field. And
Right.
people who maybe don't feel the way the herd is going sort of abandon the things that they really love. Whole dynamic of, oh, I don't want to waste my vote.
Right.
Right.
Right. What do you think overall about this?
To be quite honest, I've only read the basics. I heard about it first on NPR, and I heard Oscar, so my ears went up, of course. But the mathematics of it all, I try not to get into too much because I find all other methods to be quite confusing. But my opinion is anything that can add more prestige to the lineup is good. 10 movies being able to say that they're Best Picture nominees does make the honor less special. And the fact that perhaps a 6 or 7 wide field is going to say, okay, those other 3 weren't good enough, I think that's good. And I do also like the idea of the number of pictures making it in, being able to sort of gauge how good of a film year it was.
Right.
Is that accurate? Is that would that be technically the result?
Yeah. I mean, it
Okay.
depends on how they vote, of course. You could have a great year and they might not vote for the great things, you know.
I sort of agree with Kurt that it's, you know, if we get a year where there are 7 movies that get Best Picture nominations, and we know that they didn't have to have 7, you know, knowing that there's no fixed number that they have to have, to me makes any of the nominees feel a little bit more special because, right, if you have to choose 10, and there were only 9 good movies and Joe Dirt 2, and then, okay, well, I guess we'll have to nominate that for Best Picture, then it's a little less prestigious. But if you know that the reason that all 7 of these movies got nominated is because people within the Academy were really enthusiastic about them, it makes that revelation a little more exciting and it makes the films feel a little more exciting. And I think retroactively, we can say, oh, 2012, wow, that was a year that they nominated 7 movies. What a, oh, good times. We had the salad days or whatever. I like the feeling that this rule, these new rules, and the fact that they're not going to tell us how many pictures were chosen until they actually announce the nominees,
mm-hmm.
I think that sort of injects a little bit more emotion into the Oscars, which I'm always looking for because I get so exhausted by all the pre-Oscar awards that I sometimes feel like there's no joy left sometimes in the Oscars. But this could inject a little bit of that into it.
Oh, yeah, I fully agree on that part. The only thing that I'm worried about in terms of the new system is that I worry that if a film is really in the running, like solidly in the running,
right,
that it's going to look a little mean in comparison to how it seemed before if somebody missed, you know? Because when you know that theoretically they could have 10 nominees, and let's say, you know, like, for example, this last year, there were, at the end, there were basically 11 films still standing.
Right.
So it looked bad for the town that it was the one that at the very last minute, everybody was like, no, we can live without that one.
Right.
But on the other hand, there we knew there could only be 10, so we knew one of them had to go.
Right.
Whereas in this situation, let's say you have 8 movies that are really strong and everybody thinks they have a great shot and 7 of them get nominated and you're like, they could have had 10. And so then it suddenly looks like people don't really love that movie, you know?
But to me, I kind of like the salacious drama of that. Because it makes me think about that year that Dreamgirls didn't get a Best Picture nomination.
Yes.
And it's like, if that had happened, when that happened that year, you could think, oh, well, maybe it was 6th. But if Dreamgirls didn't get a Best Picture, if Dreamgirls had come out in a year like this, and there were only 5 Best Picture nominations, then it would have been this really interesting slap in the face to Dreamgirls, which, again, tacky, white trash that I am, I would have kind of enjoyed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I worried about that with the 10, that there wouldn't be any, you know, like things like Doubt, which I don't know how either of you feel about that movie, but I really, really thought that was a mediocre movie.
Yes.
Where I think if there had been 10 nominees at that point, it would have easily made it.
Right.
But what is special about that movie, you know?
Right.
So I do like the fact that we might get rid of some of that, so it might be fun to see what gets a picture nomination and not director and, you know, vice versa and that sort of thing.
Right. And of course, now, instantly, one wants to look back at the last 2 years and think about, ooh, had the rules been like this for the last 2 years, what movies would The Blind Side have made the Best Picture nominees list had this rule been in effect?
Well, the thing is, you did that.
Yeah, I think...
And you let The Blind Side in.
I did. And, you know, people said I was crazy and that it only had, you know, 2 nominations, so it would have been the first to go. But I view that as one of those passion index movies. So if you have to have 1 in 20 people saying you're the best, I absolutely believe that that movie would have been one of those.
Huh.
Just because people were nuts about that movie.
That's true.
Yeah.
And my basic feeling...
Totally,
yeah, and my basic feeling about the Academy, which, you know, I'm always harping on, is that they are almost, I don't want to say perfect, but they are an interesting fusion of what the general audiences feel about movies and what critics feel. That, like, they're right smack and dab in the middle of those two poles is how I
right.
feel.
That seems
well,
good.
I think it's if the past 2 years have shown you anything, I think that's what they've shown you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the 10-Y field.
Yeah.
That's what they were going for. I think they succeeded. I'm glad that they're bringing a little bit more exclusivity. Yeah, got The Blind Side. I just remember, unless I'm not remembering correctly, I think you and Roger Ebert, the day before, were maybe the only 2 people that I saw that were predicting that to be in. And The Blind Side. And, I mean, taking it over a little more, it makes perfect sense, but it was just so mind-boggling to me at the time.
They get one of those movies every once in a while.
Now, the only thing they need to do, and I've been thinking about this a lot, obviously, because of what I'm doing on the blog. But now they just need to fix the song category, and then...
Don't even get me started on that category. That is my biggest pet peeve right now in terms of rules. And as I've said before, and I'm just going to keep saying it till it sinks in, that's the only category where you're essentially allowed to vote against people.
Right.
Which, to me, is so wrong. Not be able to sabotage films you don't like, because the whole idea of the of all of those awards is that they're representative of what the Academy as a whole feels.
Right.
You know, a voting block should not be able to say, ooh, let's take down our main competition, you know? Because I can't figure... That's the only way I could possibly figure out how they didn't think The Wrestler was a good enough song, you know?
Right. Or You Haven't Seen The Last of Me.
Right.
There was... Diane Warren has made some enemies in Hollywood is the only thing that I can think.
Right. I mean, even for the people who thought the song was like a... you know, cheesetastic, you know, you can't possibly look at other nominees in that category and think that that's below them and their musical taste.
Yes, truly.
Which, as you're discovering now in your original song project.
I'm definitely with you about the preposterousness of Randy Newman winning last year. And I think you said something like he could have written that song in his garage over the weekend or something like that. And I completely agree. I mean, on top of cutting out a song that Love or Hate for Less definitely deserved to get in, it shows the least deserving to win. Yeah, very, very frustrating category, long story short.
Mm-hmm.
Truly.
Well, have you, with your project that you're doing, Mark, and you're doing that with Joe Reed, where you're going year by year?
Yeah, and we're revisiting all of the best song nominees from 1980 to 1990.
Mm-hmm. Why did you pick that decade, just out of curiosity?
Because that was the period when popular music and Oscar-nominated songs were basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. Every single year from 1980 to 1990 has at least one, if not 2 to 5, nominees that were also number one hits.
Okay.
So that trend has completely died away. But for like a good 11 years there, you could count on at least one huge hit being an Oscar nominee. So we just thought it would be interesting, since Joe and I are as geekily interested in cheesy pop music as we are in movies, to look at that category as a way of scratching both of those itches,
mm-hmm.
if you will.
Have you been surprised by anything in particular, you know, looking at them as groups?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. One thing that, because I was in elementary school for much of the 80s. I didn't realize, of course, until we started really looking at it, that the Academy would pick Pets. For like 1 year, Lionel Richie got multiple nominations, and then this couple, Alan and Marilyn Bergman, got...
Oh, I remember them.
Yeah, they got like 7 nominations in the course of 3 years, and it was just, it's fascinating to see like who the Academy decides they love, and then they just love and love and love. And it's also been really interesting to look back and think about now eligible songs that weren't nominated so that the Bergmans could get in. Like, they overlooked all of the individual songs from Purple Rain to make sure that 2 songs from Yentl could get in. That sort of thing.
Yentl. I have a soft spot for Yentl, I have to say.
Yentl was actually the year before Purple Rain. But, you know, they overlooked all of the songs from Purple Rain to make sure that some... Maybe that was the year of Phil Collins. Right. Anyway, the point is, it's surprising.
Yeah, I mean, they do that in every category, really.
Yeah.
Because they'll get on these kicks with certain actors, and once you have the benefit of hindsight, you know, like a Deborah Kerr or...
A Marsha Mason.
Or a Marsha Mason, or nowadays Amy Adams in this group, where once they decide they like them, it's just like, that's it, they're in. Years from now, it's not necessarily going to be reflective at all of what the person's best work was.
Right.
Just because they just get in these modes. It's like I have a vendetta against doubt today. But I just don't... I think when people look back on Amy Adams' career, as I hope they do, because I do think she's interesting, despite seeming possibly very generic and mainstream, that... you know, that's just nothing compared to some of her other performances.
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
Kurt, is there any pets that they have that make you crazy?
Well, I did that post for you about the afterglow, which is, of course, what we're talking about. I mean, I think we discussed last year about the whole the Jeff Bridges thing got to me. The Jeff Bridges nomination for True Grit, I felt, was undeserved. It was really just inevitable given his recent win. That was one for me. The Coens, I mean, I love the Coens, but I don't necessarily think they need to be nominated every time out. Like, I didn't think Amy Adams deserved to get in for Doubt, but then I was thrilled that she got in for The Fighter. I thought she was definitely the best thing about The Fighter. So it depends. I think it's really double-edged. I think it's very conceivable that Christopher Plummer is going to get in again this year, but I would love to see that happen. And whether that's a result of him being nominated for The Last Station, or him being who he is and the age that he is, or for actually being deserving for his work in Beginners, whatever the reason may be, I'd be glad to see it. So yeah, it goes both ways.
Yeah, Oscar giveth and Oscar taketh away.
Unless you're Meryl Streep, and then they just give and give and give.
But not the statue.
That's true. Oh my God, that's true.
Maybe it'll change this year. We'll see.
I did love that all that I had to see was one picture of her in the Iron Lady, and I found like 40 blogs that were like, "Well, she's got it. Fill it up."
Oh, I've learned
But
my.
I'm curious to see how that film does. I have little doubt about her performance with the film because it's directed by the woman who did Mamma Mia, and I mean that was a disaster. Talk about not being able to translate the language of theater into the language of cinema.
Yeah, well, hopefully she learned what a camera is.
Or
And
like
what choreography.
choreography.
Isn't choreography where you run from the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen?
Yes.
Once again, this is Nathaniel Rogers from The Film Experience, and I want to thank my guests, Mark Blankenship from The Critical Condition,
Thank you very much.
and Kurt Oselund from Your Movie Buddy.
Thanks very much. Great time as always.
And we will be back at some point in the future. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.